Welcome to What She Said on 105.9 The Region. I'm your host, Candace Sampson. There is a lot to share with you on today's show on everything from travel near and far to insightful discussions on women's health to entertainment. So stick around because you won't want to miss a minute of today's show. Here's what's coming up. Last week, I had the incredible chance to explore the stunning landscapes of Ireland's wild Atlantic Way, experiencing the rich history and vibrant culture from Westport to Belfast. This trip, beautifully orchestrated alongside remarkable women travel writers, was a testament to the enduring beauty and spirit of the Emerald Isle. Today, Kathy Buckworth, a well-versed traveler and former contributor here at What She Said, joins me to share insights that could spark your next adventure to Ireland. In the realm of entertainment, Anne Brody brings us gripping tales from the silver screen with The Beast, featuring Lea Seydoux and George Mackay, and the poignant World War II story Irina's Vow. Plus, we dive into the challenges of our global food system with Food Inc. 2. As Earth Month continues, we turn our attention to the majestic French River in Ontario through the lens of the TVO original documentary Tripping the French River. Andrea Minty, the producer, will take us on a virtual journey highlighting this vital waterway's beauty and historical significance as a Canadian heritage river. Switching gears to women's health, Sophie Salmini from Heal at Home enlightens us on managing health proactively from home with a special focus on menopause and its interaction with alcohol consumption. And for those curious about the mysterious 3 a.m. wake-up call, Kelly Boss, a leading psychotherapist, will help us decode why sleep escapes us in the early hours and how this impacts our mental well-being. Join me for an hour of enlightening stories and actionable insights as we traverse these important topics together, right here on 105.9 The Region. Last week, I had the delightful opportunity to explore Ireland, journeying along the wild Atlantic Way from Westport through the breathtaking Causeway Coastal Route and concluding in vibrant Belfast. This whirlwind 7-day adventure was beautifully orchestrated by Fáilte Ireland, Tourism Ireland, and Tourism Northern Ireland. One of the highlights of this press trip was traveling with an incredible group of fellow women travel writers, including Juanita Ng, Paula Worthington, and of course, Kathy Buckworth. Kathy, a former travel contributor to What She Said, is not only a regular on CHCH-TV and the host of the podcast Go To Grandma, but is also a current contributor at Journey Woman. Today, she joins me to share some can't-miss experiences that will inspire your next trip to the Emerald Isle. Welcome back to the show, Kathy. It's really great to have you here.
It's great to be here. I can't wait to talk about this trip. It was so fantastic.
Yeah. And I kind of love this full circle moment. Like, we were both travel contributors on this show. So it's really nice that this has come together like this, totally unplanned. So based on our recent adventure, what would you say, why would you say Ireland is such a perfect destination for women travelers?
You know, with Journey Women, we focus a lot on, or entirely on, women solo travelers at the age of 50 plus. And I think for a long time, in particular, Northern Ireland has had that sort of stigma, we'll just say it, attached to it. Of course, we all grew up listening to the troubles and things that were going on in Belfast and Northern Ireland, Derry, etc. So I think there's still that sort of lingering sort of, is it okay there? Can I travel there? Particularly, you know, as a woman by myself walking the streets at night, it's fine. So this is what, you know, this is a great thing that I'm going to tell you about. So not only the Republic of Ireland, but Northern Ireland, which of course we visited both of those, I found it to be a very welcoming country, both of them, as well as you know, everyone's so friendly. They talk to you, they tell you their stories, too many sometimes, but tons of stories. And, you know, one of the things that was great about some of the stories we heard was so many of them focused on women and the power of women in Ireland. It was such a theme without even, I don't think any of the tour guides who were fantastic that we had or in any of the locations meant to focus on the women. They're just there, Candace. It's just, there's such an important part of the history of Ireland.
Absolutely. And I find everybody just so warm and welcoming at every stop. And I think, you know, cities, I don't really go to cities a lot, but what I love is that the cities, like Belfast is really 350,000 people. And so really, it's not a big, huge city to explore. And everything was so new. You can just see the sort of this excitement of this building city after, you know, everything they went through. So that to me was huge. And this trip, as you mentioned, really highlighted the impressive legacy and current influence of Irish women, from historical figures like Grace O'Malley to the female guides and artisans we met. The strength of Irish women was evident through our journey. So what was your impression of this aspect of the journey? How did it resonate with you?
Well, as you just mentioned, it wasn't just the historical past of women and the strength that they brought to the country and to their families, but all the way up to the, maybe might get the title wrong, but the Bushmills, the head tastemaker, whatever, I'm getting this all wrong, but you know what I mean? That's a woman and that's today, yeah. Right? So the head mixer. So, you know, to hear about it through the history was quite something when, again, some of our images of Ireland might not be particularly of females. You hear about Finn McCool, the giant from the Giant's Causeway. You hear about all the strong male leaders in the political parties, and you hear all these folklore stories that you think focus on the men. But when you get into it, sure, there are folklore stories about the women, but I'll tell you, more folklore about the men and more real stories about the women. And we got the chance, as you mentioned, to go to Belfast City Hall, and they just erected two new statues to women on International Women's Day. And we found that in a few places, just this past one. So it's not like it's a new theme, but it's finally being recognized, I think, which is really something for us all to see. And you're right, there's a vibrancy to Belfast. They just signed the peace agreement 26 years ago. That is not a long time, Candace. That is not a long time ago. So they're very excited and grateful for the peace that they have. And it shows in the city and how proud they are of their city. Oh my gosh, I've never met a prouder, you know, bunch of people, and our tour guide, but everyone on the streets, et cetera. We would literally, as you know, be driving along in the van, and our tour guide would stop and say, look out the window, look out the window. How beautiful is Ireland? We have to stop here. Which is fantastic. And that was a recurring theme throughout the trip, actually. And into Derry, which is the walled city. So you feel quite contained, and it's a very easy city to walk because of that. There's certainly, you know, lives outside the walls, but inside the walls, it's super easy to walk around and see what's there and get a sense of how proud they are as well from how far they've come. But the reminders are there. As you know, the reminders are stark. There's lots of murals. There's museums. There are things there that remind us that it wasn't always okay. But again, I go back to the word grateful with them. They seem so grateful for the peace process that they went through and where they are today.
I agree. And for me, as you know, the crier in the group, I found I was really impacted. I was really impacted by the Museum of Free Derry. That was just wonderful. And also because the woman who led us through our tour lived in Canada for 30 years, Jean Haggerty. And that was just really, and her brother, unfortunately, was killed during Bloody Sunday. So to have her walk us through that tour and really share that very personal experience was just wonderful. And it just brought together the history of that city so beautifully. And obviously we went to all the other museums that they have there as well. And so for anybody invested in sort of that civil rights, social justice movement and the history of Ireland, Derry is really the place to be, I think.
It is. And, you know, and when we flip forward to today and the success of the Derry Girls, which, you know, is sort of takes us through the troubles and the series ends up with the girls themselves going in and signing the peace treaty because they're old enough to vote on it, is quite something. So while the series is hysterically funny, it tells the story of what it was really like to live your day-to-day lives as a teenage girl during this time. And the writer, Lisa McGee, that's based on her experiences growing up. But the tour guide that we had, Charlene McCrossan, in Derry, actually went to the same school and is a Derry girl. So her insights in the stories, and I, as you know, this was my second time to Northern Ireland and to Derry. And every time I go there, I get more information in terms of either the history or where they are today and where their future is. So it's really inspiring. And I was just there 18 months ago. But even since then, the changes that I saw, the knowledge that I gathered, the food that I tried was so amazing. We have to talk about the food.
Oh, yeah. We're absolutely going to that. But fans of Derry Girls absolutely must plan a trip to Derry. I highly recommend it. And let's go to the food, because that was, you know, I had sort of the stereotypical expectation in my mind of, you know, we were going to be plied with Irish stews and potatoes. And but that was absolutely not what we experienced. I know you were as impressed as I was. We started off with Croagh Patrick Seafoods and actually harvesting oysters out of the Atlantic, which was such a wonderful experience.
Yeah, the aquaculture right there is amazing. And we saw the theme of sustainability throughout the tour. at the goat farm that we're at, and different ways that they are really harvesting the land. And it's not just for growing potatoes. But historically, as we know, that's what they're known for. And what was interesting, I think, to both you and I, was the way that they didn't call a potato famine. Those words are gone from their vocabulary.
Yes.
And they call hunger, you know, the history behind that. There was food. They just weren't getting it. It was going to Britain. So they don't call it the famine anymore. They call it, you know, the hunger. But again, potato, right? We always think about potatoes. But we tried, I mean, the foods that we tried were just fantastic. And I know the last time I was there, it was the same thing. They are really pushing forward their cuisine, and for good reason. Like, it is a food destination. There's no doubt about it in every city that we were in. And we tried many different things, as I said, and they're very proud of that the food is grown locally, and that, you know, they really are inventive with their recipes and things. So yeah, one thing about Ireland that I think people miss is the food. It's fantastic.
Absolutely. A world-class culinary scene. Farm to table experiences everywhere, you know, and I mean, we had a great night in Sligo at Hooked, just incredible food straight out of the ocean. It couldn't get any fresher. So just fantastic. Mm-hmm. So from the wild Atlantic Way, our trip sort of took us to the coastal causeway, which starts in Derry, ends in Belfast. It's impossible to pick, you know, just one.
You're going
to
make me pick one.
I know,
right?
But well, what were your top experiences sort of in Northern Ireland?
Well, I think what people know mostly about Northern Ireland is probably the Giant's Causeway, and it is fantastic. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site and well worth it. Just being there is just sort of breathtaking in the scope of it and just what caused it. And I'm not going to get into the scientific explanation of it because I will get it wrong. So people will have to go and look it up, but it is absolutely breathtaking. It's fantastic. And we were lucky enough to be there. Hot tip, going Sunday morning at 9 o'clock, no one was there. And our guide said that that was quite normal because it can be crawling with visitors. It's so popular. And people have been visiting it since the 1600s. So this is not a new tourist destination. But so that was my second time there. Just as impressive the second time, don't get me wrong. But the Carrickarreed Bridge, the bridge across, I don't know, the ocean, like from, you know, was quite something. And if you look at mine or Candace's photos and reels on Instagram, you'll see really what an experience that was. And I had not done that before. And again, I think that was from the 1600s as well. And fishermen would cross to the island and bring their fish back. They did not have the safety measures in place that we had. We were no risk of falling, but it was still sort of one of those moments, right? A breathtaking moment. And the greenery of the countryside that you experience there, and the crashing, you know, of the waves in the Atlantic Ocean is quite something.
Well, you picked my top two experiences. So
I'm sorry. No,
but this is great because now we can take a quick commercial break and we'll be right back to talk more about Ireland and why women really should put this at the top of their bucket list.
More with Candace Sampson and What She Said coming up on 105.9 The Region. Welcome back to What She Said with Candace Sampson on 105.9 The Region.
Okay, we're back with Kathy Buckworth. We're discussing our recent trip to Ireland. And Kathy, you know, the Wild Atlantic Way was wild, as you might expect. 2,500-kilometer route that highlights Ireland's stunning coastal beauty. What was your favorite part of that?
Oh, gosh, so much, right? Sleeve League, which, you know, the high cliffs over there. And the whole, you know, you touched on the branding of the Wild Atlantic Way. It's so smart. It really puts it in perspective. They've been doing it for 10 years, and I think it has increased their tourism by 60%. Now, this is through the pandemic, you know, not through the pandemic when you couldn't travel, but since that, they've recovered and more. So it's really sort of highlighted the areas of that part of the island, which everyone should really see. So I think Sleeve League was probably my favorite there. What about you?
Oh, I, you know, surprisingly enough, I really thought it would be Sleeve League, which is stunning and everybody should see it. But I was quite impressed with Nephin National Park.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
And the bogs, I had no idea of the history of the bogs, let alone their environmental importance. And I was really impressed to see them sort of restoring these bodies. Were they called bodies? Is that the little cottages that they're fixing up? And so, you know, in not too long, hikers will be able to go to this national park, travel from body to body, and then, you know, sleep under a dark sky canopy, which is just breathtaking. I can't imagine how beautiful that's going to be. I have to go back for that.
And our tour guide, his great-grandmother was maybe great-great, but anyway, was one of those people who had lived in, right, these bodies or these cottages along the way. So that personal connection and the fact they'll be putting a plaque up commemorating the women mostly who held the home fires there is going to be really interesting. And I had no idea about the peat fires either and all of that. So that was news to me. And again, I've been to Ireland a couple times. So that was my bad, not noticing it. But that was, you learn something every time you go, which is what is important as well, I think, yeah, about Ireland.
And one trip will never be enough. There's no doubt. All right. So people are going to go, but there's some things they should know before they go. So what are your tips?
Well, I think we can start with the weather. So I'll just say, and they say this themselves, no one goes to Ireland for the weather. Now, that said, we had some really sunny, lovely days. But maybe expectation-wise, don't expect those. So make sure you've got rain gear. If you're going to do some of these walks that we did, make sure that you have some of the rocks are slippery. So you want to make sure you have good shoes with good traction on them. Maybe layers. We used a lot of layers, windbreakers, sweaters, et cetera. Be prepared to put those on and take those off. And I think pretty much any time of the year, the last time I was there was the end of November. And this time we were there sort of in the spring. Same sort of weather. In summer, I'm sure it gets warmer. So do pay attention to the weather. You're really going to prepare for it.
And of course, the currency, because the currency does change from euros to pounds. If you're traveling, from south into the north, you'll want to make sure you have that. My top tip would be, honestly, to pace yourself. It's a lot.
It's a lot.
You're not going to see it all. So pace yourself and really just enjoy it, because...
Hire tour guides, don't you think?
Oh,
because there is so much to see. And they're, again, so passionate about their history and their country. And you can obviously tailor the tour to what you want to do. But you will get more out of it if you use a tour guide, 100%.
Yeah, our tour, D. Morgan, is now, what do they call it? A blue badge tour guide.
Blue badge, that's right. Yeah.
And I would highly recommend people look for that designation. The amount of knowledge that she had our entire trip, I mean, I couldn't remember what we ate the day before, but the knowledge that was coming out of it was just so impressive and so incredible. And a tour guide really does make the experience.
Well, they phone ahead. They make sure you're booked in. They get your reservations. There was one thing we couldn't do because the rain, going back to the weather. So they'll find alternatives for you. So you're always going to find something to do. So many things to do. But unless you know what's there, you don't know. So hiring a tour guide will give you that expertise.
Absolutely. Kathy, thank you so much for joining me. This was it was so fun spending time with you in Ireland last week. I hope we get to do another trip soon. I hope people do plan a trip to Ireland based on this discussion. What a journey. And
what do we say at the end of something?
Sláinte.
Sinead.
Oh, Sinead.
Okay, that's all right. Sláinte is a better one because it's like, cheers. But Sinead, right? We learned that word every time we finish something on our tour. She'd say, Sinead. That was Sinead. Like, that's it. That's the end. So.
Sinead.
I'm going to read the rest of my Irish words. I got this little guide, right? So I'm going to go through the rest of my words.
All right, wonderful. Thanks, Kathy.
Sonny works on the land. Louise barely a man. There's not much to do, but he does what he can.
It's time for Saturday Night at the Movies, and Anne, what a lineup this week. Let's jump right into it, because I really want to talk about The Beast.
Oh, it's amazing. It's really sexy. It's really sort of metaphysical, and a time travel story. So we've got Léa Seydoux, who is just this superb French actor, and George MacKay from England, and The Beast is, well, you can figure out what you want The Beast to be. There are many things that may apply here. So, it's, as I said, it plays with time and space, and it's set in three or four different eras, 1910, 2014, and the future, 2042. So it's follows a couple of lovers as they, go through various things. In the most important era is 2044, because that's where they have had to hand over responsibility because AI is doing the thinking for all the humans. And she finds that a relief. They've had such a rocky relationship that she finds it okay to give up, caring so much. And in every era, there are nightmarish things that happen to them. And the cinematography is amazing. It's just worth it, even just for that. But they're constantly beset by catastrophes. And it's as though she brings them on herself because she's constantly worried that the worst thing in the world is going to happen. And it always does. So you see the power of the human mind. And it's a very difficult life for her. So you can understand that she finds some relief in the future when she doesn't have to think anymore.
I like that it played with this idea of, you know, being able to remove generational trauma from your life.
Yeah. Well, you get your DNA purified. But it robs you of all kinds of things and you're no longer human, really. But the way it's told, it's just such a masterfully made film. It's beautiful to look at. The actors are wonderfully subdued. And the script's excellent. So, you know, it's a very, very good film worth seeing. And it's a bit of a cautionary tale because of the presence and the worry that we all have about AI.
Oh, yeah. That's a knocking at our door. All right. Let's move on to Irina's Vow.
Yeah. Now, this is a true story of a woman named Hannah Gut, and she was a nurse in Poland, Polish nurse, during World War II, during the Nazi invasion. And she was arrested and sent to work as a cook and housekeeper for the commandant. So she takes on this incredible, kind job. She rounds up a group of her Jewish friends who are tailors, and she hides them, believe it or not, in his basement. So here she is, working hard, keeping everything from crossing paths. And at one point, you know, there are all the Jewish people living there, hiding there. Here a group of Nazi cars approaching. So they have to run in this huge mansion from the basement up to the attic to hide in seconds. And she's got everything figured out. It just is a total act of bravery and courage based on what she saw in the streets of Warsaw. You know, it's her way to make things right again. So a big fancy meal is being planned by the commandant, and he says, you can't possibly do it by yourself. And of course, everyone in the basement's cooking and planning, so she gets away with it. And she got away with this in real life for 2 years.
Wow.
When the war ended. Not only did she make the sacrifice of always being at risk for death, she also married the commandant so that he would be on side. And you can see the revulsion in her face. What a film. I really enjoy it. And there's an interview on the site with the star, who's actually from Windsor, Ontario, named Sophie Nellis. And she's done a few Holocaust films, but this one is, I really liked it. Really, really liked it.
Okay. Well, I want to just quickly jump to this last one because I really loved the first one, Food
yes,
Inc.
Food
so
Inc.
Food Inc. 2, Back for Seconds, looks really incredible to me. Tell me about it.
Well, you know, there's a lot of horror in it that we know about, how things are degrading, how farmers no longer can farm, how the corporations buy them over and fill the land full of chemicals and whatnot, and on about the various things, and the rise of diabetes in the African community, in the food deserts where, you know, Pop-Tarts are cheaper than apples. And also it compares to Europe and to South America, where dangerous ingredients are actually stamped on foods that are processed foods. So you always know, you always can look at this package and see what's in it that's dangerous, that's specifically marked, and avoid it. Anyway, the huge ray of life is that there is an organic farmer who has what he calls a mobile farm. So he has fresh crops for goats to eat. He puts them in front of this moving machine. They walk to the food. They eat the fresh herbs. Behind them come the pigs, and they deposit manure so that there is a perpetual supply of fresh greens. And just an incredible thing to do. And I hope it catches on. And it, you know, it's not an expensive way to handle things, but it's at Hot Docs Cinema in Toronto and Montreal. And it's really worth seeing. It wakes you up a little bit, quite a bit.
Absolutely. I would agree. The first one did. And I just came back from Ireland where we did a farm tour with this incredible family who is doing exactly what you were saying about this sort of full circle.
No way!
Yes, like the sustainability, building everything in Brogham and Farms in Northern Ireland. Amazing. So this ties right into this movie for me. And I can't wait to see it. So Anne, thanks so much. And you'll be back next week.
I will indeed.
I'm feeling so tired. Not all that strong. Sunny, don't go away.
More with Candace Sampson and What She Said coming up on 105.9 The Region. Welcome back to What She Said with Candace Sampson on 105.9 The Region.
As Earth Month unfolds, the spotlight on our planet's natural wonders and the urgent need to preserve them has never been more critical. Amidst a world grappling with environmental challenges, the serene beauty and historical significance of Ontario's French River comes to life in the mesmerizing documentary Tripping the French River. Produced by Andrea Minty, this TVO original takes us on a virtual journey down a river that is not only a Canadian heritage river, but also a vital part of Canada's natural and cultural heritage. Today, Andrea joins me again on What She Said to delve into this hypnotic paddle through time, nature, and the very essence of Canada's wilderness. Welcome back to the show, Andrea.
Thanks very much, Candace. It's nice to be here.
So Tripping the French River offers viewers a really immersive experience down one of Ontario's most historic waterways. Can you share what inspired you to capture this particular river and its significance to Canada's history?
So each year we go and have a look at what's there. We're in Ontario because this is for TV Ontario. So we're looking at Ontario places to view. And we like to think we're trying to find places either that people can't see on their own, you know, that sort of thing. And we looked at a number of rivers, but the French has such a variety visually, but historically it's one of the main links for, you know, for ancient peoples to get from the Atlantic to the Great Lakes, which was a great trading route. So, you know, the First Nations showed the European explorers how to navigate it, because if you look at the river from a bird's eye view, it's just a whole bunch of fingers and little thin areas and dead ends, and you know, very difficult to find your way from one end to the other. It's 110 kilometers long. You know, once the explorers got to see it, it became the voyageur route. In fact, the last third of the river is called the Voyageur's Canal. And for about 100 years, the voyageurs traveled down these waters, you know, on the water, portaging. The voyageurs are just, that's a whole documentary in itself. Well, a whole bunch of documentaries, but they had to be small people. So they didn't take up too much cargo space, but they had to eat tons of food every day to keep up the energy to paddle. And they'd do the whole length of the river, which is, as I said, 110 kilometers in one day, which it's pretty mind-boggling when you think people go out paddling now and in a day they cover, you know, one little section of one third of it. So it's very significant to the history of Canada. It was kind of one of the main routes to get stuff around.
And filming a documentary on a river, especially one as dynamic as the French River, must have come with its own set of challenges and surprises. Can you share any of behind-the-scenes insights from your time on the water?
Sure. I mean, every show we do has its own unique surprises and challenges, and usually they're not ones you think they're going to be. But, you know, of course, the focus was on trying to keep the camera smooth for the eye. Otherwise, you're going to feel a little sick watching it. And we found a great new camera, this Ronin 4D, which is really stabilized. It has this cool arm and it kind of looks like E.T. kind of, you know, bouncing around. He's very, very stabilized. so that we could mount it on the front of a canoe. And then we also hired a professional paddler. So he would, you know, look at the routes, he'd run the routes, he'd test the routes, and then he would take our camera person down with the stabilized camera. And even with a professional, things can happen. I mean, there was one going through the Devil's Door Rapids. You know, again, we scouted, we practiced, but almost got pulled into a rock wall, which is pretty frightening. And I mean, you don't really see it on the show, but it does happen. And I mean, imagine being the camera person in the front. You don't have any control. You don't even have a paddle. You're just hoping your canoer knows what they're doing.
Well, the name sort of says it all there, doesn't it? Devil's Door.
Yes, it does. And I mean, there are waters that look way scarier, but boy, when you're in a canoe, it's hard stuff to maneuver. You really need to know what you're doing.
How do you hope this documentary will influence viewers' relationship with nature and their understanding of the importance of preserving these natural wonders?
Well, so we take our viewers on a 3-hour trip. If we've done our job, it feels like you're doing it yourself. In this one, you're sitting in the bow of a canoe. But if we don't enrich your trip, it'll be kind of superficial. So it's not just a visual trip. We're giving you, I think we have 122 information boards throughout the program. And even though it's 3 hours and kind of slow television, boy, they keep coming at you. It's like it's hard to pause and take a break. But like, for instance, there's at one point a beaver is moving through the water. And we take that real beaver and animate it and take it down underwater into a beaver's den. And as this is happening, as we're watching this transition happen, we're getting information boards about the beaver. We're learning, you know, that it has that extra eyelid, which kind of acts like goggles underwater. We're learning that the beaver parents, they keep their kits around for about 2 years in order to teach them all the skills that they need to get out there. And one of my favorite ones is where the term mad as a hatter came from, which is that beaver pelts, I always figured they were just used for their fur to keep you warm. But in fact, they made felt out of it all. To do that, they needed mercury, I think mercury nitrate is the name of it. The fumes that came off of that would wreak havoc neurologically. And a lot of the factory workers kind of, you know, became quite unwell mentally, and hence the name Mad as a Hatter. So if people know more about the surroundings that they're passing through, they have a greater appreciation for it. You know, they may take that trip into nature themselves, and, you know, and the demand becomes greater. And I think, you know, a bit more pressure on communities to have more of that available or to preserve more. So I'm hoping that that's our little contribution to it all.
And the French River runs through a really dense forest ecosystem. Did you encounter a unique flora and fauna during the filming? And how does it contribute to the river's ecosystem?
Well, one of the things you never really think about when you're looking at water and the shoreline and things like that is what it's made of. And there are not a lot of deciduous trees along here. It's mostly evergreens. So you don't actually get much in terms of autumn colors, which is, you know, some areas are really spectacular for that. This forest or where we're passing by is not. But one of its really unique features is that it's a pool and drop type river, which, you know, I guess it gets its own kind of foliage and flora and fauna. But as a traveler on the river, which is, I'm taking a little bit away from the notion of the flora and fauna, is that because it's pool and drop, as it's a much easier river to paddle. You can go up it and you can go down it. And it's also almost impossible to not see a bald eagle, you know, pretty much every day that you're out there, which is really unusual. You won't see many in your lifetime. On the French River, you'll see a lot of them.
And the documentary, it airs online and on demand. And I can't help but think of it as sort of a virtual travel for viewers across Canada and beyond who may not be able to get to the French River or, you know, may not consider themselves outdoorsy people. How do you see this sort of format contributing to conservation efforts and raising awareness about the need to protect our natural heritage?
Well, you know what? We've been making programming like this for decades now, you know, showing people places they may not be able to get on their own. And like you say, increasing awareness, which is huge. When you increase awareness, there's more pressure to create more of it, to protect it. So it's a big voice that we can get out there. And we get all kinds of feedback from our viewers of, you know, had no idea this was there. Oh my goodness, this is so amazing. You know, thank you for letting me go there because I'll never get there on my own. Or people who are going as a result of having seen it. So I think we are making that contribution of increasing awareness.
I know just myself watching the footage, I feel a draw now to go explore the French River myself. Like I would love to be out there canoeing. It looks spectacular and so peaceful. Did you find that?
It really is. And I mean, it has three dramatic personalities. There's the top, the middle, and the bottom. The bottom is my favorite part. It's called the Voyageur's Channel. And that's where you get all the drumlins and the narrow passageways, probably a lot of portaging. But it's just at times you feel like maybe you're in a Tom Thompson painting. There's no sound. It's so personal. There are other parts where it's much bigger, wider, and a very different feel. But boy, that Voyageur's Channel is stunning.
So what's next?
Well, every year we slug it out. And now we make it for TV Ontario. So we're limited to Ontario. But I mean, it's really not that limiting. We haven't selected a place yet. So we're still in the works. And every year, our program format really lends itself to trains and waterways. Roads, still trying to figure out whether we can make that work. I don't know what's next, except that it will be another place that people don't get to that often.
All right. Well, in the meantime, where can people find Tripping the French River?
So the program premieres on TV Ontario on Sunday, April 21st at 8 p.m. But once it premieres, it will stream for, well, I'm going to say 5 or 7 years. So you'll see it for a long, long time.
All right. Excellent. Is there somewhere that people can connect with you or follow along with you on social media, Andrea?
Yes, we're on. Oh, my goodness. I'm not sure I know the actual addresses offhand, but we're Tripping the French River on Instagram and on Facebook. You'll find us there quite readily.
All right. Perfect. Andrea, thank you so much for joining me again. It's a pleasure.
Thank you, Candace. It's been great fun.
No, I don't know what to say. Mistakes, honey, we both made mistakes. Even if we changed up the pace, don't know if I go on.
Today I'm thrilled to welcome Sophie Solmini, the innovative founder of Heal at Home. This organization champions a proactive approach to health, empowering individuals to manage their well-being from the comfort of their homes. In today's discussion, we're turning our focus to a critical yet often overlooked aspect of women's health, menopause, and its relationship with alcohol consumption. Sophie, it's great to have you with me today.
Thank you very much, Candace, to have me.
So let's start to unpack this a little bit. Can you help us understand how alcohol affects women differently, especially as they approach menopause, and what makes this phase of life particularly sensitive to alcohol?
Sure. So to starting with, there's a difference between men and women in terms of how we process alcohol. Women have more fat and less water. So to starting with, we are less equipped to handle alcohol than men. Second, the problem is the way we use alcohol more than anything. When we start to enter menopause, we start to experience some hot flash, night sweat, anxiety, depression, lots of things that we were not prepared to starting with. So we are not sure why we go through all those stages, and then come the alcohol. What we used to drink in the past might have an effect more important now because there's some changes, and with the unbalance of hormones, our body have more difficulty to handle alcohol as is used to. This has also another impact on how we use alcohol to cope with those new feelings, you know? So when we start to feel like, okay, I have difficulty to sleep, why not having a little nightcap, okay? By doing this, we even affect more our symptoms because now we put oil in the fire. So it's like this vicious cycle. So we have some new pain, as I would call. We have more difficulty to deal with all those changes. And we add on top of that alcohol, which could also lead to severe complications. We are talking about heart disease, osteoporosis. So it has a lot of impact on our body.
Just anecdotally from my own experience, I can tell you that my relationship with alcohol completely shifted when I entered perimenopause because the struggle to sleep was so big that I had to basically stop. Like, I drink it on special occasions. I still enjoy alcohol occasionally, but nowhere near what I did prior to entering perimenopause because it was just having such a profound impact on my quality of life, and it exacerbated my hot flashes so much. It was awful. So I totally get this. So hormonal changes obviously are a hallmark of menopause. How do these changes alter how women metabolize alcohol?
It's difficult to know because every woman is different, you know, and it's a new field, believe me or not, okay, that now everybody starts to think, oh, maybe we should address menopause symptoms, okay? So it's just a new field. So people just start to get interested in it. For me, I can just comment on what I see as someone who deal with women. I became interested in the menopause, like you, when I started to enter in the phase. So I started to ask our client because I have seen an influx of women in those last couple of years since COVID. As a matter of fact, 80% of our clients are women. So I started to ask the question innocently, are you in perimenopause? And it was like, yes. And women didn't make the link between everything they were experiencing and the overuse of alcohol and what shifted. You know, women started to tell me, yes, I used to have just two glasses of wine and I was okay. Now after one, I'm swamped. And it was this like uncomprehension, if I might use this word. I'm not even know if it's a word, but women started to question, oh my God. And they didn't do the link between what they were experiencing and how the hormones unbalance has an impact on everything, not only alcohol, but on everything. But the go-to coping was drinking. And now it's difficult to get out of this cycle, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And what you said about, you know, during COVID, that was exactly when it was really impacting me. And I wasn't making the link because there was so much going on. And oftentimes it's hard for us to draw connections. We were in lockdown. We were under a lot of stress. Alcohol is a coping mechanism a lot of us reach for. And of course, though, when menopause steps in, it's not, you're not getting the same connection or the same effect you maybe had when you were younger. So how does Heal at Home help women then with this, I guess, connection or disconnection from alcohol in their life?
So what we do differently than others is that we use medication-assisted treatment in our approach. So every time someone identifies a problem with alcohol, we automatically involve a medical part to the mix. So not only you see a therapist to deal with the regular triggers that you might have, certainly for menopause, you have the trigger of feeling depressed, you know what I am used for. I'm going really candid with you, but I have a daughter who was entering puberty while I was exiting, you know, and it was quite a strange relationship because now we were both like teenagers, you know, fighting against each other because of the mood swing and everything. So, and I couldn't know why I was going through these things. So by having this addressed through therapy was good, but also with the medication-assisted treatment, our client have a chance to talk with a nurse practitioner, not only how to deal with the alcohol, but also maybe there's some other stuff that I need to address in order to treat the whole package.
I have to tell you, you made me chuckle when you said your daughter was entering puberty as you were starting to transition. It is perhaps one of the cruelest tricks nature plays on us is to have these two dynamics in a household at the same time. It's really, really challenging. So, but for those considering reducing or even eliminating alcohol from their lifestyle, what supportive strategies can you recommend to make this transition smoother?
First of all, I never tell people that they should stop, okay, or that they should abstain, because people know what works for them. However, I encourage people to first assess their relationship with alcohol. And to do that, the first thing is to track how much you drink. Because if I was to ask you how much you drink, you would tell me, occasionally, when I'm meeting with people, recreationally, okay? What does it mean? Because occasionally, recreationally, socially could mean every day. So it's difficult to know exactly how much we drink. So my first strategy is for you to take a pen and paper and start tracking the numbers, okay? And go by drinking unit, okay? 5 ounces of wine, it's a drinking unit. At the end of the week, you check how many did you have during the week. Now, this is not a clear picture, so I would go for another week because usually when we pay attention, we are not really real. So you go for 2 weeks, now you look at the numbers again. Now you have two solutions. Do you want to decrease? Are you happy with what you see? If you are not happy and you want to decrease, start trying to reduce. So there are strategies. Number one, every time you have an alcoholic drink, the second one should be a non-alcoholic drink. Okay, trying to space it. Always drink with a full stomach, okay, to take time to process. So, and also be mindful. You know, when you drink, something that I found really powerful is to be an active drinker, not a passive drinker. A passive drinker is someone who pours, like me with my coffee. I don't even know how many coffee I have a day. I'm pouring, okay? When you are an active drinker, you decide, I'm going to have just one. I'm going to have two. And when you have one, you sip it, you enjoy it, you take your time. So you control. So those are strategies that could help you manage the alcohol consumption. And if it doesn't work, and if you start feeling like, oh my God, I'm struggling, it's time to look for help.
Sophie, thank you so much. I feel this is a really great conversation, and I'm so happy that it's a much more open conversation now in 2024 than it has been ever. Mm-hmm. But if people want to reach out to you and find support or find out how ways they can work with you, what's the best way for them to do that?
So they can visit our website at healathome.ca or send me an email at sophie@healathome.ca in one word. And we start from there. I'm always happy to answer questions or to guide people.
All right, wonderful. Thank you so much for joining me today, Sophie.
Thank you very much.
More with Candace Sampson and What She Said coming up on 105.9 The Region. Welcome back to What She Said with Candace Sampson on 105.9 The Region.
You will want to stick around for this next interview because it's a topic that many of us can resonate with. It's the mysterious 3 a.m. wake-up call when sleep eludes and thoughts whirl. Joining us to decode this phenomenon is Kelly Boss, a seasoned psychotherapist and a leading Canadian relationship expert. With her TV show Well Said and as the co-owner of Muskoka Mind and Body and Couch Counseling and Psychotherapy, Kelly brings a wealth of knowledge on mental well-being. Let's unravel the mystery of the 3 a.m. wake-up call with Kelly. Welcome back, Kelly.
Thank you for having me, Candace.
I love that you're here, and it's all related because I posted on Facebook that I woke up at 3 o'clock and I could not get back to sleep and just was so tired. And so many people jumped into my comments because we're all struggling with this. So can you explain this?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's not uncommon. I think the reason you had so many comments on the Facebook is because people had done it earlier that week or the week before. They also had 3 a.m. People call it monkey brain or busy brain. And sometimes we cannot shut off the thoughts. I think that's usually what's happening. Sometimes you just can't sleep and you're not really identifying with a lot of worried thinking. But I think a lot of us, it just seems like the perfect time for our brain to think about what are the many worries I can bring up today. Worries that I haven't thought of in 2 years, worries that aren't even that relevant the next day. Like our brain just latches onto anything.
But why wake up? Why are you in a dead sleep and then suddenly you're wide awake and your mind just won't stop racing?
Well, I don't always think we know. Sometimes it is about a bit of a pattern, like maybe biologically things are going on or there's noises or something's waking you up. And sometimes I think that we then latch on to that little bit of wakefulness and then we're awake, we're thinking about things and it goes from one to another. And as I talked about, you know, it can be things we didn't even think were a problem. And our 3 a.m. brain is not our best advisor. It's not.
No kidding.
Right?
Sorry, but you say that you mentioned that we can interrupt our thinking even at this odd hour. So
absolutely.
Let's dive into some skills and strategies for this.
Yeah, absolutely. So what happens is we get woken up for some reason, and our brain starts to find those worries and we think worrying helps. It doesn't, but we think. I tell clients all the time, if I gave you an hour to think about this or another 5 minutes, are you going to really come up with that many more solutions in the next hour in your sleepy brain with its bent on problem solving? It's not good. So what we need to do is interrupt it. And the biggest thing with this is learning to interrupt it with something we believe, because our brain will reject the things that we don't believe. So for example, if I said, it's okay, I'll just go back to sleep, and I don't actually feel the problem's okay, then that's problematic. So I remember doing this. I was teaching a lot of anxiety courses at the time, and I thought, okay, physician, heal thyself. Like I should really try and interrupt this. So what I started saying to myself at 3 a.m., if I had a worry that was keeping me up, I'd say, I don't need to think about this right now. And the truth was, I believed that. I do. I 100% believe that this is not the time. So it really helped me go back to sleep. And you know, maybe it takes a little coaching. Maybe it's like, I can pick up on this tomorrow at 8 when I wake up. I can think about this more later. Like something that you believe that will tell that your brain will accept and be more adaptive, which is I can think about this tomorrow. This is a super useful technique in interrupting those worried thoughts.
And so for people who regularly wake up at 3 a.m., what additional resources or practices would you recommend?
So obviously, sometimes it's definitely talking to your doctor. There might be something else going on. You know, I'm not a physician. I'm a psychotherapist. So I'm just telling you some things that have helped my clients. So any kind of the CBTI, it's CBT for insomnia. If you ever see a course on that, that can be very useful. It does a couple things. One is that it's going to help you interrupt your thinking. But it also looks at the time you go to bed and how much time you're spending in bed and really looking at your sleep hygiene as well. And it's a whole course that can help you sort out some of the sleep issues. Those are great things. And then a simple pen and paper. Sometimes we are awake because we don't want to forget something. And we'll think, I got to remember to call the dentist tomorrow. And then we repeat it over and over and over. So sometimes it helps. It's better out than in, is just grab that piece of paper, jot it down, and then you can look at it tomorrow. Hopefully it's legible.
I've heard that people should get up. You know, yes. If you can't get back to sleep, you should actually just get up. Is that true?
Absolutely. That is after a certain amount of time. We're looking at 15 or 20 minutes. If it's just like you've gone up, gone to pee, you know, you're up for a little bit. But if you're lying there for what seems like a significant time and you've tried to interrupt your thought and say, don't think about this now, then you can get up. They suggest doing something fairly rote, like maybe it's organizing the silverware, or it's reading a book, or something not too exciting. Some people say like read the fridge manual, like really make it boring. But I've heard you can also just read for a bit. And then what they usually get you to do is go to bed when you're actually sleepy, when your eyes are heavy, so that you start associating bed with the place you can sleep, not the place you can't sleep, which lying in bed awake does.
Good advice. We were talking prior, and there are so many things out there that we can take anymore to help us sleep. But I worry that those things are addictive and habit forming. And obviously, the best way to get to sleep is naturally, and the best way to stay asleep is naturally. So you talk about this. You share things all the time on your social media channels. Where can people keep up with you for more advice on sleep? And of course, a host of other things we're dealing with in 2023.
Yes. So you can find me on Instagram at Kelly Boss Therapy, Facebook, Kelly Flanagan Boss Therapy. My website is kellyboss.com. It's 1S. And then I'm often popping in on different things like visiting this fabulous show and giving tips there as well.
All right. Incredible. Kelly, thanks so much for joining me today. And here's to a good night's sleep.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's it for What She Said this week. Stay up to date with our newsletter by signing up at whatshesaidtalk.com and be sure to follow on social at What She Said Talk on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter for videos of these interviews and more. You can also catch me on TikTok at Candace Said. Finally, be sure to subscribe to What She Said with Candace Sampson on Apple and Spotify to catch past episodes and extended podcasts. I'll be back next week with another What She Said on 105.9 The Region.
Previous episodes of What She Said on 105.9theregion.com.